financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How are you?
I am hanging in there, I will say that.
Yeah. Well, on the other side of a holiday, you know, a lot of people have super stress. And some of that's about money. Some of it's not, right? We all have stories about these crazy things that happen in the middle of our holiday season. But one of them happens to be finance. And, you know, it's great to run around saying, happy Thanksgiving, you know, happy holidays. But they're not happy to everyone. And I want to do what we can to maybe alleviate some of that today and to just, you know, talk about the elephant in the room and what we can do about it. So if you're feeling a little hopeless or a little down at the holidays and money has something to do with that, listen to this show because there are things you can do, whether you think so or not. And that's probably the biggest point here is that you may well think that you have done everything possible and you may be sure of yourself and you may have talked to your friends and your family and nobody has anything to offer. But you need to remember that they're not professionals at it. They either don't remember what it was like to not be able to make ends meet, or things have changed and what they know isn't relevant now, or they just don't get it. They just don't know who you are. So they say things to you like, don't forget to save off the top, pay yourself first. You know, for anybody out there who has not been able to you know, they're counting their pennies like, am I going to get gas or groceries this week?
Yeah, if you haven't had a red strip on the top of your electric bill, then I don't want to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Jess. Exactly. A red strip on the top of your electric bill. So I think we need to talk about what happens. And it's very rare. I want to preface this by saying almost always when people come to us, there is some solution. It may not be the same solution, right? It's not cookie cutter. It's not always here. Just put your debt in the system and do this. A lot of times people can't. They're in trouble. They're up to debt in their, you know, to their eyeballs. Or recently I had a case where a woman had filed a bankruptcy before coming to me. So I didn't have that as an escape route for her. But when she filed the bankruptcy, you know, her credit card debt was discharged, but her student loans weren't. Her mortgage wasn't. Her car loan wasn't.
So it's easy to get right back into the same situation.
Well, she never got out of the situation. You know, the sad part about this is if we had looked at this first, we would have seen the problem together. Mm-hmm. We would have seen if you file this bankruptcy, here's how much money in monthly payments will be discharged. Mm-hmm. Let's look at your expenses. Oh, this is a problem because even after you discharge that, you still have too much in expenses for your income. Mm-hmm. And you no longer have credit because you just filed a bankruptcy. I'm sorry for laughing at this because it's not funny, but to me, it's just so avoidable. You know, it's so avoidable.
And I'm sure people don't factor in too that after you file a bankruptcy, any loan you go to get for the next 7 years, you're going to be paying more, right? If you're even able to get one.
Well, yeah. Well, so let's get rid of that scare tactic first.
Okay.
That people have, they have this fear about filing bankruptcy. I won't be able to get a loan for 7 years. That's not true. You will need to rebuild your credit and you will be able to get a loan if you rebuild your credit within a relatively reasonable period of time. I estimate a year and a half to get a car loan if we're actively working on repairing your credit, a year to a year and a half to get a car loan, maybe 3 to 4 to get a mortgage. Okay.
Well, that's but better than I thought.
Yeah, you have to be proactive about it. You have to do the work to rebuild your credit. And we have all these little tricks of the trade to do. For example, don't go out and apply for a credit card and get declined and then say, oh, gee, I'll try again, because that decline has gone on your credit report. It would be better to talk to us and find out which credit card am I going to get approved for. And it doesn't, by the way, here's a hint, it doesn't have to be a secured credit card.
Okay.
So there's just one little thing. If you thought you knew how to rebuild your credit after bankruptcy, and the only way to do it was to get a secured credit card. Thank you for playing. You're wrong. There are more things you can do. Okay. So the point about all of this is that it is never hopeless. All right. It might mean that you have to make some short-term sacrifices. The other thing that might have to happen is a long-term solution. And you might not like it, but you know what? You're not going to like being homeless either. And if you really have, and now I'm speaking to people who have been, I'm going to say good with their money, or at least, and people might be shaking their heads like, good with their money? Well, how do they have no money if they're good with it? Either they've been diligent and tried to reduce their budget as much as they can and not make poor decisions, or they just have gotten into this position because of, let's say, a divorce, or they're perhaps widowed. Something has happened that they've lost their income. Even, you know, people who have income coming in because they're raising children, and when those children turn 18 or 22 or whatever the divorce decree might say, that income stops. I know when you start taking that income for children, you say, I'm not ever going to use it. It's only for my kids. But you know what? Life happens to people. And the thing I take exception to mostly, I think, is the attack on people who have fallen into some sort of financial peril, as if they were all just haphazardly just, you know, buying, you know, sweaters and bonbons and
big screen
going
TVs,
to expensive concerts.
Yeah.
Are there people who do that? Of course, there are people who spend money like the old phrase was a drunken sailor, you know. There are people who spend money carelessly and end up in a bad place. But there are more people, in my experience, at least the ones we talk to, who really didn't do that, but who have ended up in a place where they just think they can't make ends meet. Now, a lot of the times that's true, but let's suppose that you know, it's not true, right? You think you can't make ends meet. You come to us, we find some solution. Sometimes it's putting them in the standard hug your money plan where we pay off that debt really quickly, track their expenses, and help them with retirement planning. Sometimes it's about reorganizing very carefully. Here's another thing you can do really badly. You can consolidate your debt, not know the outcome, and end up shooting yourself in the foot because now you have a new consolidation loan with one big payment that you have to make every month. You never pay off those little pieces quickly like we do. You never get any breathing room. And, you know, you would think, Jess, that bankruptcy attorneys and bankers would see this coming and they wouldn't advise you to do these things. But it just isn't true. They don't have, it's not their job, and they don't have those tools. If you go to a bankruptcy attorney, they ask you to build this little budget. It's hysterical if you really want to look at it. I mean, how much do you spend in groceries? I mean, it's all estimates.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing in there like that's really specific. Like, let's track your expenses for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and see what you're really spending. Right. So, you know, you can really get yourself in trouble if you don't do this well. And I know we have some questions to get to, too, but which we can do in the second half. And I'll also give you some ideas of things that you can do that are short term fixes and long term fixes. Even if you have done everything you already can, your budget is trimmed to the bone, you don't think there's anything left to do, there's still hope.
All right. Well, we're going to get to questions in the second half. Actually, pause here for a second. We're only at 9 minutes. Do you still want to go here for a little bit?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I got the wrong.
That's
I
okay.
do. I got the
I can
wrong
edit this
time
little
in
part
my
up.
Head. I
okay.
knew that seemed fast. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. So, go ahead.
I did have a quick question. It's kind of a little sidebar, as we do sometimes. Why is it legal, or this is a legal question, I guess, so you can just give me your guess. I just don't think it's fair that if you apply for a credit card and get turned down, they can deduct on your credit score. It makes you not want to apply for anything ever.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll agree with you on that. I think that's not great. I understand why it happens, but I would prefer that they just put the denial on your credit report like an inquiry, and didn't affect your score, right?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, look, but you have to understand, Jess, that credit scores, FICO, Fair and Isaac, the two guys that developed this lovely system. Yeah, thank you very much, Fair and Isaac. Credit scores are designed as a means to assess risk for lenders. So a lender is able to look at your number rather than read your report and say, well, they're a good risk, they're a bad risk, they're a great risk, whatever. So when a company looks at your credit and declines you, other companies want to see that as if there's been a little research done, right? So they say, oh, so-and-so declined you. Oh, I see that your score dropped. Okay, well, we don't like you now because your score is 579 instead of 620 or whatever, right? It's not fair necessarily, because very often a decline is because of something that is erroneous on your credit report, or something they didn't understand, or maybe they had different criterion than somebody else will have in order to lend to you. So,
I
you
totally
know,
understand. I totally understand any company having the right to deny you. Absolutely, they do if they think you're a bad risk. But
sure.
then to get dinged on top of it just seems a little aggressive.
Yeah, it's rubbing salt in an open wound a little bit,
Yeah.
right? You're denied, and we're going to zing you for it. So you know what my advice is always here is the first thing you do is you don't just apply. You pull your credit reports. I always recommend annualcreditreport.com directly through the credit reporting bureaus. Pull all three of them and scrutinize them. Go right through. They're pretty easy to read. They seem a little scary at first, but there's instructions there. Go right down the line and see, okay, this isn't necessarily accurate. I don't remember ever being late on that. And dispute it, because it's free to dispute these things. And you can dispute them right there online. Then wait 30 to 45 days, pull them again, see if your credit's cleaned up, then go and apply.
Okay.
Okay, so yeah,
Good
don't.
advice.
Otherwise you really do cause yourself more of a problem
Can
than you
you
want.
find out from some of these companies, like say you were trying to apply for a specific visa, is there a way to call the company and find out what credit score do you normally accept? Is it normally like a
Sure.
650, a 680, whatever, so you know kind of ahead of time?
Yeah, I love to do that. That's a lot of what we teach people is how to figure out how to play the game and then use that to your advantage. And so, yes, you can call. Now, you'll probably have to get a supervisor and you'll spend a little time on the phone. And the way to ask, I'm going to give this to you here. Here's my free tip of the day. You don't say, what credit score do you need for me to be approved? Because they won't be able to answer it. What you say is, hypothetically, if I were to apply and I had, let's say, a 620 credit score, would that mean possible approval for me, or do you require something else? And you need to remember that the people talking to you on the phone are either being listened to, or they might be in a facility where other people hear them. So they're probably not going to go, no, you need 720, you know. But you can learn a lot about that. But you probably will have to get past the front line to do it. But it's worth doing. It's really worth doing.
Yeah, definitely, because then you know whether to apply or not, whether your credit score is going to get dinged or not.
Yes. Yeah. So I love that you ask questions like that, because you're a regular person, right? And you have, and not a financial geek. But they're important questions. And I know you have some other questions too. And I do want to talk in the second half about things that you can do if you've already trimmed your budget as much as you can trim it, and you think there's nothing else to do. You know, what's left?
And I just want to do a little plug here really quick that if you are out doing your Christmas shopping now, your book would be a great present if you're a parent and have kids and want to give them a little advice. If you are, you know, are getting ready to retire, let everybody know about the book and where you can get it. I think it'd be a great gift for anybody.
Thank you, Jess. I have to say that was a complete surprise. I didn't know you were going to do that. Very nice. That's very nice. Yes, it's Retire Debt and Retire Well. Not Retire Debt or Retire Well. Retire Debt and Retire Well. And you can get it at Amazon.com.
All right, and where can they get a hold of you on the phone?
Sure, 413-773-3333.
And hugyourmoney.com is the place to go. We've got questions coming up in the second half of Financial Fitness. Hang tight. We'll be back with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hi, Jess. Thanks for hanging in there with me.
Yeah,
Okay.
we're talking about it being a little overwhelming this time of year. It is for a lot of people.
It is for a lot of people. And as we talked about, if you're having financial, difficulties, it comes with more baggage at this time of year, I think, when people are trying to, bring food to somebody else's house or buy presents and money is really tight. It can really be excruciating. And I say that firsthand. I know I've told this story on the air and I won't go into it today, but I remember many holidays that were very bad, but I remember one Christmas in particular where I was so ashamed and so embarrassed, and I just couldn't afford to do anything. And I didn't want to go to my family's house for Christmas, and love prevailed, and they called me and dragged me down there, and I had a lovely Christmas, but not without a lot of tears, and I was really feeling awful about it, and I
Yeah.
just got the willies again of thinking about it. So I want to talk to people who maybe are really struggling and who are feeling it more at the holidays even, that it is not hopeless. I know you might feel that way, but it is not hopeless. So let's talk about some things you can do. I want to leave time for our questions too, but let's talk about some things you can do. So first thing you can do is you can contact a pro and really go through your expenses, not just your hard costs, but how much do you spend on, I don't know, co-pays or birthday gifts or, coffee. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to feel penalized, that you can't spend this money. But the hardest thing to do is to address this accurately. Instead, what people tend to do is what I call cherry picking. Oh, this money thing's really got me. I guess I'm just not going to eat out anymore. Or I'm going to trim my cell phone bill. I'm going to cut my streaming. And they cut as much as they can, thinking, okay, that's the solution, but still without a bottom line number, a real bottom line number. So when we do the hug your budget thing and you put all your expenses in there, we really see the bottom line. And that's what's so important, no matter how you do this, is to identify how short you really are on, in my case, 5 feet. Ha ha ha. So, how short you really are, what kind of deficit you're running on every month. And then you can address it. It will be a little painful, but not as bad as continuing to beat your head against the brick wall, right? Because that's what makes it so hard is that you don't have a solution and you keep doing it. Okay, short-term things you can do. You can either trim your expenses or you can increase your income. Now, if you've already trimmed everything you can trim, and even if you've seen a pro like us and we've trimmed everything and it's still just staring us in the face that you have to increase your income and you're working 50, 60 hours a week already, what are you going to do about that? So, some short-term things. I know you won't like this, but you could consider a roommate. You could put somebody in for rent in a room, doesn't have to be a separate apartment. Maybe they rent a room from you for a short period of time, like maybe a traveling nurse or a teacher who's, only here for one semester or something like that, just to get you kind of over that hurdle. You don't have to go full Airbnb with this thing, okay? Try something like that and see how that might work for you. There are other income streams. Like at this time of year, we see the signs up that say Christmas light installation, or UPS is looking for drivers, or something like that. You could take in some alterations, whatever. It doesn't have to be a lot, but once you identify your deficit, then you can go about trying to fix that, right? You say, gee, I'm running $300 upside down every month. I'm going to fix that. Okay. Long-term things, you can file for other benefits like heating assistance, housing, food stamps, anything that you might qualify for. Maybe the VA, if you're a veteran, might have some things to assist you. So think about that. But in terms of like a side hustle, even those small things like things we talked about will really help. A lot of people are driving people to medical appointments these days and getting paid to do that. I know there are some huge companies that offer to do driving things, and some of them pay well and some of them don't. So be very careful about that. But I know people will say, well, I want passive income. I don't want to have to work actively for it. But passive income often means that you have to sort of start up a business, like a vending machine business or something that makes money while you sleep. So be careful about that, particularly if you're already, running on a deficit. Be careful about investing more money on the hopes, in the hopes that you're going to get out of it with this passive income. Start first with the active stuff, get yourself on your feet. So I hope this helps, but I will help anybody who wants to talk to us about this, of course. And I promise to leave room for questions. So shoot, you got questions.
Well, one actually ties right into that. I'm going to skip ahead to that one. Is about an ADU that they're approved now, but the initial investment to get it ready to be able to rent would be about 25 grand. Is it worth it to do that? You're not probably going to see a return on that for, I don't know, depending on how much you charge for rent. So they want to know whether that's a good investment or not.
It depends on how they do it. And how long they're going to rent. The math might say, look, we're going to recoup this in a year at $2,000 a month or whatever, right? And so that's worth doing. But the practical math might not work. That how are they going to do that? Do they have the money to do it? So that would be a place where I would say, let's look at the whole picture and let's juggle some things to see if we can get this to happen maybe without increasing your monthly outlay at all by
Okay.
doing some creative financing. But yeah, I think anything that will increase your income long term, if you're willing to do it, might be worth some investment. You just have to be careful not to harm yourself doing it. Yeah.
Okay. Michael D. from Amherst wants small business advice. He wants to start a small business selling food, but can't afford the local business rents unless he moves to a rural area. He sometimes sells food at local farmers markets, but wants a more permanent presence in a downtown area. Do you have any advice for him? What could he do about the rent? He's worried about losing money in his first 2 years.
Yep.
What would be the major pitfalls?
Well, he's smart. Restaurant
Okay.
businesses are one of the top businesses that fail. The first pitfall, I would say, is do the gut check. Does he want, and this is so common, not just in the restaurant business, but in lots of businesses, is he in love with the idea of having a store, of having a restaurant or a storefront where people come in and he's got brick and mortar? Is he in love with that idea, or is he really thinking that there's a reason he has to have this storefront in order to advance his business? And would it, in fact, increase his profits by enough to cover that rent? Some advice I would give to him is to check the local community development center in his area. These are
Okay.
people who have great resources, often free, usually inexpensive. They help you with things like business plans. The one here in Franklin County has a kitchen. I mean, that like, who's it? Michael's Pickles. Somebody's Famous Pickles is done in. And when the Four Leaf Clover was open, they did their barbecue sauce and all of that. It's an entire registered kitchen that you can
Oh, that's
provide
great.
stuff from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing might be that he might be able to work out some deal with a place like an Elks or a Moose or a Lodge that has a kitchen that isn't necessarily being used often, but
Oh, that's a good idea.
they already have the kitchen, and they might be willing to
Yeah.
let him use that, maybe even use it to provide food for their patrons at a cut rate. So there, I mean, obviously I'm just touching the tip of the iceberg here, but people ask these very direct questions like, will I be able to pay the rent or not? And my mind immediately goes to, well, let's tip that on its side and figure out whether it's the right thing for you or not, and how creative can we get about it? Well, I could go on for an hour about that easy, but let's go to the next question. I hope that's helpful to Michael, though.
All right. Sammy from Northampton wants to help her two daughters with college expenses, but doesn't know what the strategy should be. Should she give her daughters a credit card with a strict limit? Should she co-sign loans? She owns a small home, worked hard to save money with her husband, wants to avoid incurring too much debt as she approaches retirement.
Yeah, well, great question. So yes, you want to teach your kids by example. Should you co-sign loans? No, you shouldn't co-sign loans. I hate co-signing loans, but you will get boxed into it anyway because the kids can only get so much money as a freshman, sophomore, junior for student loans, and the rest of it falls on the parents. So I would love to tell you don't co-sign the loans, but you will probably get stuck co-signing some loans. However, don't co-sign things you don't need to. Okay.
Okay.
Then the credit card with a limit or so. Yeah, I like that idea. I would almost rather, though, that it was a debit card tied to a separate account with a credit card logo on it. So if they need a credit card, they can use it as a Visa or MasterCard, but the money is actually coming out of the account. It isn't going on to a credit card that has to maybe get paid at the end of the month. They will still be able to learn how to use that money. If you want them to build credit and you don't want to give them a credit card, put them on as an additional user on your card.
I was just going to mention this because this is one of the tips from you that I've held on to since we started the show, was
Oh,
what a
really?
great idea this is. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. Well, so then you pay your bill on time. They're going to get credit. Don't give them the card.
Right.
Just when the card comes in, don't give it to them. But go ahead and pay that bill and build some credit for them so that they have something when they get out of school. But instead of just handing them credit blindly, teach them along the way to use money wisely by putting a finite amount of money in that account. It can only get recharged when it needs to. They have to come to you and say, I spent all my money. What did you spend it on? This is a learning process. This is a wonderful question, and I'm so glad that she sees it the way she does about not getting herself into trouble as she's approaching retirement as well. And probably the best gift she can give her kids is to teach them along the way through example like that. Yeah, great
Okay,
question.
great. All right, that was Sammy. Angie from Greenfield, we get this question a lot, wants to know when it makes sense to buy, finance, or lease a car. Does it ever make sense to lease? She has an aging Buick, the 2011, but isn't sure if buying makes sense given her very tight budget. She's got a family with a kid and a pending separation, makes around $60,000
a year. Well,
Pretty
the pending
specific,
separation is the first thing that makes my eyebrows go up, because I'm wondering if she's scrambling, like, what happens if I get divorced? How will I be able to get a car? So I have to do it now, right? Sometimes people do that. I would caution her to talk to her attorney about this. If she hasn't gotten an attorney already, at least get a free consult. I know it's hard to face, but what happens if things don't work out for us? Where am I financially? Will I be able to buy a car or not? Not that they'll look at her money, but they'll tell her what the ins and outs are, how that gets divided if the worst happens for her. Does it make sense to lease a car? Yeah, I actually have a two-part video on this that's clients see it in our membership dashboard. But it makes sense to lease a car, in my opinion, either when you're in our program already, and I can see that we're going to pay off quite a bit of debt in the next 3 years, and that we're going to prepare to be able to buy that car out in 3 years. That's the best way to do it, to win the game that way, and then not to lease too much car. In other words, don't lease more car than you could have bought. So if you could buy a $30,000 car and the payment is, at whatever, $500 a month, but you can lease it for $250 a month, let's lease it for now. And then buy it out at the end, but only inside the program when we're paying off debt. The problem with leases is you never get rid of that car payment. And so people will just trade in one lease for another, but it keeps going up, 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 up. Now, some people say, well, that's okay because I want to drive a new car. Fine if you can afford it, but this woman is on a reasonably limited income and facing possible financial, disaster. I hate to say disaster, struggles, maybe.
Troubles, yes.
Yeah, troubles. So the other place it makes sense to use a lease is if it's deductible for your business in some way, or if your business needs to lease a vehicle. That's a question for an accountant. I would almost prefer, if she will call me, that we talk about whether to buy or buy new or used and how to make that work within her budget, so that she doesn't have that, hey, what am I going to do in 3 years from now, given her personal life at the moment. Yeah. And I do want her to talk to an attorney.
I know we're gonna run out of time, but another piece of advice you gave that I remembered, which I thought was great, was that you could buy a used car, but go to the bank and find out what year they cut off that you can get the longest loan for. I
Yeah,
thought
the
that was
sweet
great
spot.
advice.
The sweet spot. Yeah. That's why I said if she'll call me, I'll go through that with her. Yeah. Yeah.
All right,
Great.
perfect. It looks like we're gonna be out of time, but before we go, I want to let everybody know that sent in a question, you will get a copy of the book, Retire Debt and Retire Well. If you want to send a question in, and we use it on the air, you'll get a copy of the book. And you can send those to jtyler@whmp.com or to hugyourmoney.com. You'll get those. And if we use it, yeah, you get the book.
Thanks, Jess. Yeah.
Be a
Happy
nice
holidays
re-gift
to
for
you.
Christmas, by the way.
Yeah, it is. I know we'll talk again, but in case somebody doesn't catch the show between now and the holidays, really wishing everybody a happy holiday season. And if money is worrying you, please just call us. It's so addressable. No matter how bad you think it is, don't let yourself walk around feeling badly at the holidays or any
And
time.
what phone number can they reach you at?
Thanks, Jess. They can reach us at 413-773-3333.
And you can always go to hugyourmoney.com. Happy holidays to you too. I'm sure I'll talk to you before then, but thank you so much. We'll be back again next week, right?
We will. Thanks, Jess.
Another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor. I'm Dr. Francis Raham, and my guest slash partner host today is somebody I really want to introduce to you. She's somebody that I'm very grateful to have on our side, and we call her our public access specialist. So you may have heard her on the phone. She may have called you or emailed you, but I'd like for you to meet Deborah Emerson. So
nice
welcome,
to meet
Deborah.
all of you too.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. So, you know, to come clean, I have wanted to do this kind of a show with you for a long time to really introduce you to people and talk about a little bit about how we work together to get the word out about financial wellness through TV and radio. But because we have a holiday coming up, I wanted to do the show today and just talk to people about Thanksgiving, not about money, just about Thanksgiving and all the things that we might be grateful for, and a fun story that that you might not have heard somewhere else, just like most of the things we tell you. So Deborah's done a little research, I've done a little research, and it turns out that I'd like to tell you a Thanksgiving story that you will be able to share with your family without getting into an argument, I hope.
Around the dinner table, maybe.
I hope. Around the dinner table, exactly. So let me just start by saying, I just want to play quick word association, and I will tell people I did not prep Deborah for this. She has no idea what's coming. She's being clandestine in the room. Okay. With her headphones on, right? Okay, quick word association. Name one thing you're grateful for.
My job with you.
Oh, come on. Really? Thank you. Okay.
I know it's true. I love working with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I'm grateful for my home, for my dog, for my inner world, and the love I can share with everyone on the outside world.
Yeah. I think, you know, we were talking about this off the air a little bit, that feeling of gratefulness, if you're fortunate enough to have it or to recognize it.
Yes.
No matter how awful things might be, most people can find and try to find something good. And that feeling of gratefulness can really lift you up and inspire you. And inspiring is what creates these new kinds of ideas for people, entrepreneurs especially. If you were to say, you know, what am I grateful for? I mean, the list is too long, but one of the things I'm grateful for is the talented and intelligent people that I get to work with when we're developing new and creative ideas. And of course, you know, medical advancements that allow people to live longer. You know, I have a sister with a bilateral lung transplant. Astonishing, right? Lots of people with medical problems that are solved now. So of course, I'm grateful for Lola and for my health and for, you know, just a multitude of things. But in part, that feeling of being able to be inspired by others around me leads to entrepreneurial developments. And
it's contagious. When you are open in your heart and you're grateful, it's contagious.
It is. So, all right, here, I'd like to tell you this Thanksgiving story.
Okay.
We're going to wind the clock back a little bit.
All what right. year are we in?
It's 1953. Okay. Now we're going to go back in history a bit, but I just want to start this off. It's 1953. I want you to imagine 10 railway cars full of perishable goods, perishable, frozen goods. And the only solution at hand at the moment is to keep them running because that's when the refrigeration works. And so you shuttle 10 railway cars full of perishable items between Nebraska and the East Coast over and over and over again until your executives can figure out how to solve this problem. Okay.
That's problematic.
It's problematic. 260 tons of, we might as well say it because we're talking about Thanksgiving, turkey. 260 tons of turkey, frozen turkey.
Many turkeys.
We had a bad holiday season for the company Swanson, right? And so this is a story that you'll be able to tell around the dinner table without getting into an argument with your family, without talking about politics. And it's fun and it's got some interesting parts to it. Okay. 10 railway cars back and forth between Nebraska and the East Coast with frozen turkeys in them and a bunch of executives, you know, scratching their heads going, what are we going to do with these frozen turkeys? Now, you might think you know the answer to this already, and you might, but did you know the history behind it? Okay. So So, without giving away the answer, let's just say that this problem and solution started as early as 1925. Okay.
Is that Clarence Birdseye?
It is Clarence Birdseye. You're absolutely right. So, 1925, Clarence Birdseye is a naturalist, right? And he's getting complaints from people, I imagine, about freezing fish. When you freeze fish and you thaw it, it loses its texture, it loses its flavor. So Clarence Birdseye comes up with a solution, something called the double belt flash freezing method, apparently. He comes up with a solution to quickly freeze fish. All right, maybe that doesn't sound like much. How am I linking frozen fish to frozen turkeys in 10 railway cars, 20 something years apart from each other, almost 30 years apart? All right. So what's the problem and what's the connection? The problem is that most people didn't have ice boxes in those days, right?
Right,
We're not talking refrigerators, folks. We're talking
ice
boxes.
boxes, and sometimes you had that little freezer component up above that you had to de-thaw all the time, remember?
Yeah, defrost, right, exactly.
Or
So
defrost, yeah.
people would come and on a wagon. In fact, I'm dating myself here, but when my father, who's now long gone, was a little boy, he used to ride on the back of the ice wagon and help deliver the ice. That was
Oh,
one of
really?
his jobs. Yeah. And they would bring this block of ice and put it in your ice chest, right? It was your ice
Way
box.
to refrigerate, yeah.
Right. So not many people had ice boxes, and refrigeration vehicles were rare. So keeping fish frozen or keeping foods frozen had to be done in a way that when you thawed them out, they hadn't lost their flavor and their texture.
And they were safe to eat.
And they were safe to eat, exactly. So now let's get to, let's say, 19. You pick a year. Did you have something in between there you wanted to say?
Well, because it kind of all started with Maxim sky plates on airlines. That's how it all started. And so they had a special oven built on airlines to cook these sky plates, which usually had a protein, a vegetable, and a starch. So you got a three-course meal. It was warm, it was tasty. The challenge was, how do you keep like fried chicken crispy? And so I guess they conquered that challenge. And so that's how it started on an airplane.
Wasn't his oven called like the whirlwind oven or something?
Something like that. Yeah, Maxim actually, I guess, built that oven for these
That,
sky plates.
I think that WL Maxim or somebody, do I have that right? Let me check. Yeah, WL Maxim in 1944. So
Okay.
we went from the frozen fish in 1925. There was something in the 30s. I forget who it was, but there was something that happened in the 30s to bring that forward. And then by 1944, World War II, the Maxim food systems, right? And they sold those prepackaged frozen dinners, as you said. Now they sold them only to military and civilian air carrier on civilian air carriers.
And Navy, yeah,
Yep.
exactly.
We still don't have these frozen dinners in the home yet. We're still talking about where they are sold other places. Those dinners were called strato plates or sky plates. The ones you're talking about, strato
Yes,
plates or
yes.
sky plates. And they were reheated in the planes on those whirlwind electric ovens, which was basically
Yeah.
a precursor to a convection oven, what we call
Yes.
a convection oven. Okay.
And they had shelves that they could cook six at a time, and then they built bigger ovens that cook more at a time.
It's amazing what you can find when you look this stuff up, right?
It is.
Okay. 1947. Well, first of all, he planned to expand that into a larger commercial, wide, worldwide, or at least nationwide effort, but he passed away before he was able to do that. So in 1947, Jack Fisher comes on the scene as an entrepreneur, and he has something called Friggy Dinners.
That's right, I
Friggi,
recall.
Friggy dinners. And those are marketed exclusively in bars and taverns with the idea that you don't have to pay a cook and you can still feed your hungry patrons, right? Okay. 1949, right? We still aren't up to Swanson yet. 1949, we have Albert and Mayer Bernstein, the brothers, who founded Frozen Dinners Inc. And they produced more than 400,000 dinners under a label, which I'm sorry, folks, if this is politically incorrect. I can't change the guy's label. One-eyed Eskimo. Don't know why.
Yeah.
So you that know was, why?
So no, I don't, but those were sold in stores at the time?
They were sold in stores.
Or sold to the military.
400,000 dinners. But I'm not exactly sure. Those were sold at the home level. So in 1949 is when they finally started to hit home level. By 1954, after forming Quaker State Food Corp, that these two brothers formed, they sold more than 2 million prepackaged items of those dinners in the stores. Okay.
That's a lot.
That almost brings us up to Swanson. By the time, right around that time, C.A. Swanson and Sons was, they already were well known for their poultry and chicken pot pies, right?
Ah.
Yeah, but they'd had this.
We all remember those as children, right? We all remember
chicken, that. Oh, Swanson dinners. Yeah. I mean, even the ads, I remember the ads for them. So right around this time, they kind of get this idea that, oh, you know, we're already famous for this stuff and somebody else is doing this, but they're not thinking much about, well, let's make some TV dinners, right? So
no,
this,
no.
So TV dinners didn't exist yet. So now these have been selling, they've been doing well. Swanson goes into the holiday season, doesn't sell as many turkeys as they'd like to, and they are stuck with 520,000 pounds of frozen turkey.
A lot.
A lot. And what are they going to do with it? So they decide, well, they don't decide. First of all, they shuttle them back and forth from Nebraska to the East Coast because
to keep them refrigerated.
That's all right. They could do. The train railway cars only worked. They only refrigerated while they were traveling back and forth.
Amazing.
So one thing I have to say about this is it's pretty amazing that they even figured that out while, like, hey, what are we going to do with these frozen birds while we figure out what to do, right? So now there are several versions of who inspired this. I mean, there's no doubt that at this point where they decided to do this and market these dinners, that it became today, you know, whatever, a multi-billion or trillion-dollar industry, right? It's a quarter of a trillion-dollar industry today.
Is it? Wow.
A quarter of a trillion dollars. Now, we have to credit, you know, Stouffer's and Banquet for jumping on the bandwagon and producing those.
Hungry Man.
Hungry Man. I mean, you name it. People who have dinners in trays.
Yeah.
Would, you know, got there because of this idea, because of
That's
a problem. So when we're talking about inspiration and entrepreneurship, this is the kind of thing that is a defining moment. Okay.
Finding a solution.
It is finding a solution. So I want to talk more about that in the second half. We'll take a short break, and I promise to let Deborah talk more so that you can get to know a little bit about Deborah and meet her more. But at this point, I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. If you can stay with us for the second half, please do that. And you can always reach out to us for help, of course.
We're always available.
We are.
I think, Frances, you should give out your phone number.
So the number here is 413-773-3333.
And then what about your website?
Sure. They can reach us at hugyourmoney.com. Hug like everybody needs a hug. Happy Thanksgiving, and please stay with us for the second half of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor. I'm Frances Rayum, and my guest slash colleague joining us today is Deborah Emerson. She's our public access specialist. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you.
We are talking about Thanksgiving. We're actually talking about a fun Thanksgiving story that has to do with a solution of having 260 tons of frozen turkey left. If you might feel that way the day after Thanksgiving yourself, at least today we can put that in a freezer. But back in the day, that was problematic. And so it led through some inspiration to the development of what is known as the TV dinner today in the early 1950s. And as we've talked about, there's a little history of people doing things that were similar to that, but not marketing it in the home until Swanson started to do it. And that was their solution to trucking these turkeys back and forth on railroad cars from Nebraska to the East Coast. So 1950s, they start packaging this stuff in little mini TV boxes, complete with the knobs and everything. And they target women, and they're 98 cents a piece.
And it was a brilliant campaign. No pots, no pans, no dishes. You can throw the tray away when you're done. What's not to like about that?
And the prestige that everybody wanted a TV at that point. So
TV sales went up, and TV trays to sit in front of the TV went up.
And it was all marketed at women. And today, now where we have Instapots and microwaves and, you know, air fryers and everything else, sous vide ovens, whatever we have, today we laugh at this, but their big pitch was dinner in 25 minutes.
98 cents.
For 98 cents. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the inspiration behind this. And then I really do want to share a Thanksgiving story or two with people. Just sometimes when I do this, people write back to us, or they call and leave messages on the office line saying, hey, I heard your Thanksgiving story. I can beat that. This is what I've got. But and these are really, you know, it's a difficult time sometimes for people to get together with their family. Other times people love it. Sometimes people aren't getting together with family at all. I had an assistant who worked for me for many years, and every Thanksgiving, even though he had a family, what he did was volunteer at the local soup kitchen.
Oh, that's a lovely gift to give back.
When his kids were small, he had them come with him, and they learned the value.
A good lesson. Yes.
Yeah, it was really, really sweet. Anyway, let's talk about the inspiration behind the TV dinner for a moment. So there are several different ideas about how this happened. What happened, you know, the fact that it became an enormous success is undebatable, right? But how it happened, who was responsible for it, is in question. There was a man named Jerry Thomas. Jerry Thomas was getting paid $200 a month working for Swanson. He'd been there a few years, and he was a salesman. That was his job. One version of the idea is that Jerry Swanson sees this frozen food aluminum tray at a distributor's warehouse.
I think he also took a transatlantic flight or something, and he noticed it in the airlines.
That's the other guy.
Oh, okay.
That's the Swanson guy. Yeah. So Jerry Thomas, actually getting paid $200 a month as a salesman, is at a distributor's warehouse in Pittsburgh, and he sees this aluminum tray. Meanwhile, the turkeys are going back and forth from Nebraska to the East Coast.
And nobody's linking it yet.
And Jerry Thomas goes, aluminum tray, frozen dinners. I don't know, maybe we can use these turkeys for this frozen dinner thing. He brings the idea to the Swanson brothers, and Swanson says, yeah, this is great. We're going to forge ahead with this idea. Now, the legend has it, if you will, it's probably legend by now, that Jerry Thomas was paid $1,000 for his idea and got a promotion. $250 million today, $1,000 in a promotion. But the other, some multiple sources, including people that work at Swanson and some of the Swanson family members, credit the two brothers, Gilbert and Clark Swanson, themselves with this idea, stating that Gilbert was inspired by that airline food on that trip that he took to visit his banker. Yeah. So there's a book called How Cadillac Got Its Fins and Other True Tales from the Annals of Business and Marketing. It's written by Jack Mingo. And Jack Mingo claims that Gilbert named the TV dinner after hosting a party at his house where people were balancing the food on their laps in front of a TV. Who knows? In any case, somebody inspired it, and somehow it became the TV dinner we know today. Okay.
And then they decorated the box as if it was a TV.
They sure did. You know, here's this guy selling enormous amounts of units. In 1954, they sold 10 million units, excuse me. And in 1955, 25 million units a year later. And it just kept going exponentially. And as I said, now Stouffer's and other companies have jumped on board. If that leads you to bring your memory back to being a kid, now I know for a lot of our viewers and listeners, you know, they don't remember any of this. But for many of our listeners and viewers, they totally remember TV dinners. If I said Salisbury steak to somebody,
Oh, definitely TV dinner
Absolutely,
item.
TV dinner. And you brought up fried chicken TV dinner, right? What were some of the other ones? Do you remember any of the other ones?
It was beef stew. It was just meat products, I think.
And
Chicken, turkey,
gray
pork,
peas, lovely things like that. Yes.
cheese, potatoes. And it wasn't until future that they actually thought of putting a dessert component
Oh,
in
do you
there.
know when that happened?
When they sold it to Campbell's. Campbell's was the one that produced the dessert component, like applesauce or stewed apples, whatever it was. And I always ate the dessert component first. But then that parlayed its way into making breakfast trays. So you could do this for breakfast too. It was very good marketing.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You brought up off camera the idea of the aluminum pans and lead, and I was like, honey, it's 1953. They don't care about lead at this point. They're just dinner in 25 minutes for busy women, you know.
And now I think they're put Campbell's didn't use aluminum. They used some sort of other material. It was like a, I don't know if it was plastic. I don't know what it was, but.
Well, even that is very interesting because Campbell's is famous for soup. They're not putting
And they
soup in
actually
these
put some
trays, but
soup. They put some soup in their trays.
they did?
Oh, yes.
No
There's a
kidding.
little bit of soup, a protein, starch, vegetable, and a little dessert.
I had no idea. Okay, the things you
I saw
learn.
some pictures.
Oh my gosh. Okay, now I said maybe we'd tell some Thanksgiving stories, and you said, oh, I don't have one that you like. Did anything come to mind?
No.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
But I know
Yeah.
you.
So I remember Thanksgivings, and this is much like a lot of people. You know, the world has gotten smaller. Children move away from us easily now, and families have, reduced in size. And so what I remember as a young girl, having 25 people at the house, coming in from Boston or whatever, all the family around this enormous table with the kids at the second table. And, I remember all of that. That's not it today. I mean, today, we have two or three people, or we do a Friendsgiving, or, maybe a family. So, but the, cost is still a factor. Actually, without getting into the math, this year your TV dinner will cost your TV dinner, your turkey dinner will cost you about $90. Turkey is actually down this year in price.
Is
So,
it?
oh yeah, it's way down. It's like a
I'm
buck
sure
a
it's
pound in a lot of places now. So anyway, so that's the idea. Now, I have this one story I'll try and share relatively quickly with you that has to do with my niece and her first cooking episode at a Thanksgiving get together. And to understand this, you have to understand that my niece Anne is just the sweetest soul, right? Her heart is so warm and so dear. And she, when she gets laughing, now we're only 3 years apart, so we grew up almost like sisters, right? She's 3 years younger than me because my sister Diane is 18 years my elder. So we laughed and laughed and laughed as children. And when we would get laughing, it was hysterical. But I love stories like this that unfold. So Anne is about to come to Thanksgiving dinner and she's old enough to cook something. And she says, I want to cook all the pies. I will bring the desserts. Don't anybody cook any pies. I'm bringing them. Okay. Now we only have about six people at that Thanksgiving, but she makes four pies, two apple, a pumpkin, and something else I don't remember. The apple and the pumpkin, however, were very memorable. Anne comes completely, completely naive about what she's really bringing. She's baked these pies and she comes, and we're kind of looking at the pies, and the apple pie is literally black. It looks like lava.
Black.
Okay, is at the top of it is completely burned without exaggeration, and the squash pie looks normal. So I go over and I say, I see that you brought these pies, honey. Oh, that's lovely. What is this one? Oh, that's apple, she says. Now she's got no idea this is going to be funny to me, right? It's apple. Okay, well, it's a little dark. Yeah, I had a little problem with my oven. Well, what happened? Well, I started cooking the pie and I cooked it for 45 minutes, like they said, and it didn't seem like it was cooked. So I called my friend who cooks at the local restaurant. Kevin was his name. I called Kevin and I say, what about this pie? And he says, well, it should be cooked by now. So she takes matters into her own hands and she turns her oven up to 600 degrees. I remember her line. I said, you've turned your oven up to 600 degrees. And she said, just for the last hour. Or half hour,
Oh,
whatever it was. Hour or half hour,
that's
whatever it was.
horrible. My oven doesn't even go up to 600
Oh,
degrees.
mine does, but it's clean. I mean, at that point, you're just
Oh,
locking
that's how
it up
you
and
clean
cleaning it. Yeah,
your
yeah, yeah. I said, Ann, you didn't cook the pie, you cleaned it, okay? 600 degrees. But we move on from there a little bit. I try to console her. It'll be okay, Ann. What about this squash pie? No, pumpkin pie.
the
Pumpkin
pumpkin.
pie. Now, you could not make this story up. I slice into the pumpkin pie and it just fills itself back in.
Is it raw?
Completely soupy. I don't know if it's raw or not, but I start to ask her, what about this pumpkin pie, Ann? And she starts to tell me the story. Well, I was going to make it from that can, you know, that can of pumpkin that, you know, Nana makes the pies from. But I
And there's
thought,
a recipe on the
I
back of
don't,
that.
yeah, but she said, I don't think I want to bring a canned pie to Thanksgiving. So I had this pumpkin left over from Halloween.
And she used that?
Yeah, she used that. Now you have to
She's
understand.
obviously not a baker.
No, you have to understand that my sister Diane, although she's a lovely person, her idea of gourmet cuisine was, you know, boxed macaroni and cheese. So these
Ooh.
kids really grew up separate from our household, really not learning how to cook anything. So anyway, I hope that this wasn't too silly for people, that we gave them some Thanksgiving things to think about and to enjoy, and maybe something they can laugh about at the table. And also that they got to meet a little bit of Deborah Emerson. And I hope that you'll come back and join us at a time when you can do most of the talking.
Absolutely. Well,
Yeah.
I am an only child, and so I never had crowds of 25 at my dinner table. So, you know, my life was a little quieter
A
here as well.
very different experience, and you didn't have to
Yeah.
eat the pies. So.
No, my mom made mincemeat pies, which I didn't like.
Anyway, I think we should say together Happy Thanksgiving. What do you think?
I think we can.
Okay.
Yes. So
One,
happy
two.
Thanksgiving to everybody. I'm so happy to meet all of you and to be part of this process with Francis. And you can contact us anytime.
So happy Thanksgiving, and I do mean that from the bottom of our hearts. And you can always reach out to us. We are here to help, whether it's Thanksgiving expenses or some other financial thing. We are here to help at hugyourmoney.com. And you can reach us, of course, at 413-773-3333. May you have a wonderful, a grateful, a safe and loving holiday season. And we will see you the next time on Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is sponsored by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.